Afternoon, we'll call to order the House Committee on Rules for Monday, March 4. Today we go back to something I never thought I would talk about again. Redistricting. I'm going to open a public hearing on HB 2686 and HJR 17, and we'll kick things off with Representatives Bailey and Berger.
Great. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Jules Bailey, proud to represent House District 42, and to be before you on HJR 17. Mr. Chair, you know better than anybody in this building the enormous weight and gravity of a redistricting process and the importance that it has for the fundamental underpinning of our democracy. And part of the message of HJR 17 is that we can't necessarily count on every 10 years having the kind of leadership that we had in the last session to be able to pass a balanced, fair, and accountable redistricting plan. HJR 17 is part of the conversation to say, how do we ensure that we get a redistricting plan going forward that is one that represents all the values that we have as Oregonians, that is fair, that is accurate, and that is unbiased. And it is going to be an ongoing conversation. It's a conversation that I'm pleased to be sitting with my co-sponsor, Representative Berger, as part of that conversation. And I'm pleased that the City Club of Portland has done the yeoman's work on producing a report that has recommendations within it, and we're appreciative to them for keeping this conversation going.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Vicki Berger, I don't know how I can improve on the remarks he just made. It seems like we just finished that. Do we have to start talking about that again? The truth of the matter is I've been here long enough to be through two of these. I was not an elected member in the 2001, but I was well aware of the effort. And as our process gets to be viewed as more political and more political, I am looking to another way of getting this core function done that assures Oregonians that it's not a completely political process, that it is done in a fair and sort of independent-minded process. I thought it was stunning what we were able to accomplish last session, but I think it was partly a function of the right people in the right time in the right place, and that won't be assured going forward. So when this was brought to me, I said, oh, please, we just went through that. But the truth of the matter is we're going to go through it again. Now is the time to set the table and start this conversation, not waiting until it's right before us. So I think this is an important conversation, one that I'm deeply appreciative of the work that has been done, and I commend your attention to it, and thank you, Mr. Chair, for hearing this.
Thank you. Any questions for our colleagues? All right, thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Excuse me. So we have three visitors from the City Club, Carl Twombly, Carl Van Roer, and James Opsink, please. Come on up. Go ahead, please.
Well, Chairman Garrett and members of the committee, thank you for hearing our testimony today. I'm Carl Twombly. I'm with the City Club of Portland. And we have James Offsink and Carl Van Roer. We have a presentation for our House Bill 2686 and HJR 17 to establish an independent nonpartisan redistricting commission.
Maybe we should dim the lights. Can we do that?
This first slide is the darkest. After this, it gets better. Chair Garrett, members of the committee, my name is James Offsink. I live in Southeast Portland, and I'm speaking to you today on behalf of the City Club of Portland in favor of HJR 17 and HB 2686 to create an independent, nonpartisan redistricting committee to perform redistricting in Oregon. The City Club's involvement in this started in 2009 with a study that looked at excessive partisanship in the Oregon legislature. We went around and interviewed legislators and other people knowledgeable about the politics in Oregon and asked what the causes of increasing partisanship were. And consistently, legislators and others pointed to redistricting as being one of the foundational issues that exacerbated partisanship in the state. With this input from the legislature, we decided to perform a year-long study of redistricting where we examined the history of Oregon's redistricting process and other processes across the country and followed closely what was occurring here in 2011 and elsewhere in the nation. We interviewed members of the 2011 Redistricting Commission, thank you, Chair Garrett, as well as other regional experts, members of the media, and academics. And what our research determined was that, among other things, what happened here in 2011 was truly an historic event. And our research concluded that there were several key factors to what happened here and why it happened. So the first, as Representatives Bailey and Berger have already highlighted, is really key leadership. Thank you to Chairman Garrett, Senator Courtney, Representative Lindsay, and others who are very invested in seeing the legislature complete this important task. The second aspect that was reported continually was the character of individual relationships that were created between legislators as they went around and listened to public input throughout the state. And lastly was the split balance of power with evenly divided House, narrowly divided Senate was also listed as a contributing factor. So while we think that some of these are desirable or commendable, we don't think in conclusion that these are factors that Oregonians can count on to occur in 2021, 2031, or beyond. So this motivates why we think now is the right time to rethink redistricting in the state of Oregon and come up with the ideal system for future generations of Oregonians. And that brings us to the legislation currently under consideration, HDR 17 and HB 2686. There are a number of facets to these bills, but most importantly, they create an independent commission to handle redistricting in the future. There are a few minor additions that we're recommending, which are included in the materials we've submitted. Overall, the adoption of an independent commission will remove the perceived conflicts of interest and will continue Oregon's reputation for being a national leader in good government issues. Two key components of any redistricting process are who draws the lines and what process do they follow, which I will now briefly walk through. Some of the goals we're trying to achieve in the commission were to ensure that commissioners were sufficiently competent and independent, and to the greatest extent possible, that they reflected some of the diversity of the state. So the first stage consists of people nominated for their knowledge of statewide issues. The groups and individuals solicited for nominations are included in the materials, but include former governors, former Supreme Court justices, members of Congress, as well as the Oregon Commission for Women and Commission on Indian Services. These nominations would be screened for conflicts of interest, including large campaign contributions, being a registered lobbyist, or holding partisan elected office within the last 5 years. The legislative leaders, the House and Senate majority and minority leaders, would agree on 4 members from this pool of qualified nominations that would serve as the first 4 members of the commission. These members would then choose the remaining 5 members from a pool of citizen applicants. So the final commission then would be 9 members and would have a diversity along gender, race, political registration, and geographic origin. Geographic diversity is somewhat difficult to quantify, but at the very least, there would be one commissioner serving from each congressional district. The second important aspect of any commission or any redistricting plan is how those making the lines will operate. So this slide is kind of an overview of that. I apologize that it's a little bit complicated, but the legislature would provide the initial input into the commission. We heard repeatedly in our interviews that legislators really have the most specific and expert knowledge about issues that face the constituents that they represent. That would be followed by public input, much in the way that the 2011 legislative committee handled it, traveling around the state and soliciting public testimony. That feedback would then inform draft maps, which would then be shopped around the state again, and then that the feedback from that would inform the final maps. We would also specify that the Supreme Court is the court of original jurisdiction for hearing challenges to redistricting. So any sustained challenges would be returned to the independent commission for modifications. There's been a lot of interest and activity lately around redistricting as some states consider allocating their electoral college votes by congressional districts, and as members of the media call out gerrymandered districts as being responsible for the imbalance in Congress and also for the partisan gridlock that's hurting our nation. It's difficult to know which of these concerns are legitimate, but it's uncontroversial to say that the importance of redistricting is only becoming more acute, as is the importance of having a fair and credible process that works for all voters. 2013 is the time to make changes to the redistricting process. As it gets closer to 2021, it will only be more difficult to make changes as power structures solidify and there's a perception of one party winning at the expense of the other. Good government reforms are rarely anyone's top priority. Budget and education bills, public safety, and other ever-present legislative issues have a justified tendency to take focus. However, the bills we're discussing today, like all good government proposals, while not the seemingly most immediate priority, deal with the very fabric of our representative democracy. Thank you for this opportunity to testify before you today. The City Club appreciates the leadership you've shown on good government issues in the past and encourages the committee to help Oregon continue to lead the nation by recommending the passage of these bills.
Thank you.
So I will take a couple of minutes here. Chair Garrett and members of the Rules Committee, I would like to thank you for the opportunity to come and testify here, and I really enjoyed meeting several of you in the last few weeks talking about this. So I also am speaking on behalf of the City Club Redistricting Advocacy Group. And what I'd like to do is talk a little about redistricting more from the national perspective. So James described the study that we have done, and of course, part of what we studied in 2011 was...
I need to get your name for the record, if you could.
Harl von Rohr.
Thank you.
Sorry. You need any more information?
We'll get to that.
An important part of what we studied in 2011 was redistricting processes in states across the nation. And it was an ideal time. It was kind of a laboratory. And, of course, at the same time, we were paying very close attention to the redistricting committee here in Salem. From all of this, well, we learned a lot of things, but looking at other states, one thing we learned is that every state is different. And every state has its own redistricting story. I mean, it's pretty amazing when you start looking at all of these. Some of them stick out in the news, and some of them you never hear about. But it's also apparent that there are patterns that developed. I want to talk about just a few of these sort of categories. A few of these redistricting stories are actually fairly short and really didn't have much controversy. There were only, that was a rare thing, but I would point to, say, Iowa as an example of that. But all too many of these stories were long and arduous and drawn out, and really they brought out some of that intense partisan rivalry that can really poison meaningful political dialogue. And that was kind of sad to watch. And some of these processes actually are still going on, either in the courts or, in some cases, still in the legislature. There were things going on in Virginia recently that they still haven't resolved their redistricting. Some of these stories showed that with strong legislative leadership, with a willingness to compromise, and with a real desire to reach a conclusion, that legislative redistricting can be very successful. Just the way it was intended in Oregon. And that is the story of Oregon in 2011, which James alluded to. And I will just say it again. We were impressed, and, you know, we really would like to compliment the people involved. That was a great thing. Other states, and there are really too many of these, have a story which is of particular concern to us. And this is that scenario where you have one one party that's really holding all the cards. So you know what that means. They have the governor's office, probably other executive offices in the state, and of course, both houses of the legislature. And in those states, all too often, that power that they had, of course, they have all the power in that situation, was used excessively, drawing lines that blatantly favored their interests or the interests of the party above the interests of the people in the state. And that also is sad to watch. I would point, for instance, to Illinois and Ohio as examples. In Illinois, it was the Democrats drawing the lines, and in Ohio, it was the Republicans. We don't want this one-sided approach to be potentially the story of Oregon in future redistrictings. It certainly wasn't recently, but we don't want it in the future. Legislative redistricting here in 2011 was a success, partially thanks to the fact that we had an evenly split legislature, we had great leadership, and there was a willingness to compromise. But we don't really know what the situation will be in 2021 or 2031. I mean, political winds change. And it is possible that one party will control the governorship and the Secretary of State and both houses of legislature, which is the case right now as well. The good news is that in Oregon, at least currently, we don't seem to have that culture of extreme partisanship that you see in many states across the Union. We definitely have our share, but when you look at some of these other places, like Wisconsin, I think it's, you know, it's not nearly as extreme. But, you know, it's hard to tell what the future will bring, because actually, when you look at projections, there are trends that show that there's a real increase in political polarization nationally. So one thing we did was we looked back to see, well, when was the last time that Oregon actually had one party that controlled the governor's office, Secretary of State, and both houses of legislature? And we had to look back a long way. I'm a history teacher, so I might ask you the question, but I won't. So it goes back to 1951. So I was 3 years old. The governor at that time was Governor Douglas McKay. He was a Republican, but of course, back in those days, you know, the Republican Party, the parties were really different than they are today. Certainly the alliances they had, and redistricting was very different in 1951. It was even before the one man, one vote. But it's this scenario, if it were to happen again during a redistricting, that we are very concerned about, and it's one of the reasons why we've brought forth this proposal. That we don't know what would happen in Oregon, and we are concerned that one party or the other, even in Oregon, could be vulnerable to overstepping the limits of a fair and balanced redistricting. We don't really want to put our state or our future legislators to the test. It's not really worth it. So this is one of the main reasons why we support the idea of an independent commission for redistricting. An independent commission would have some separation from the heat of partisan politics. It would reduce the chance of an overly partisan redistricting solution, and it would certainly eliminate that perception of a conflict of interest when legislators are drawing the lines. One other thing that these bills would do is that they would codify a process that would ensure transparency and input from both the public and the legislature. Independent commissions are already working in several states around us, and the number is increasing. And we would like to add Oregon to that number. So this is a change that we can, and I think we should make now for the future of our state. And I would urge you to support HB 2686 and HJR 17. Thank you.
Thank you all for being here and for the work that went into this proposal. I've always been a big fan of the City Club and the work you all do, and this is a very interesting idea. Are there questions for the panel? Yes, Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I came in late, and I apologize for that. I was working on some other matters, and I don't know whether anyone talked about the criteria for districting. We have a law, of course, and have constitutional provisions that set forth the criteria under which redistricting is to be done by whoever does it. And I wonder if in the process of discussing your issue of the process of redistricting, you considered the adequacy of the current rules for under which the criteria for redistricting is to be done.
Yes. Could I answer that, Carl Twombly? Yes, thank you for your question, Representative Barnhart. We looked at Oregon's set of criteria, and we think they're a good set. One thing that Oregon doesn't use versus other states is compactness, and I think that's appropriate. We didn't suggest including compactness. There's a lot of regions where you will follow the geography, natural rivers, coastlines, and you'll end up with districts that are not necessarily as compact as they could be. But some of the research we did led to us to conclude that the set of rules, if codified, can have far more benefit in terms of reducing gerrymandering than even whether the legislature versus the commission is doing the work. We read a couple books, and we've looked at some of the documents from the Brennan Center, for example, or Common Cause, and based on that research, we do have a good set of criteria. Some states don't have any other criteria besides equalizing the population, and we specifically did not want to add compactness because I think that's appropriate. That's apt for Oregon, and then we're adding to try. It's their trade-offs between the criteria, but we're also adding another one to say minimize the change for districts. Washington, for example, has a limit of 2%. We don't have a limit, but just to try to minimize the number of people whose districts are changed. but the other criteria are a good set, and we're codifying it. And the research said having a good set of rules is the best way you can do it, and it's much improved from states that have only equalizing populations.
Follow up if I could. Yeah. There have been lots of comments in the national media lately about attempts to use congressional districts for presidential electors. And the criticism of that, at least in some of the places where it's considered, has to do with the reality, apparently, based on their stories, that the congressional delegation from those states is significantly skewed when you consider, when you compare the outcomes of elections to the numbers of voters for the two parties, members of the two parties in the election. I assume what that means is that the majority, the party that wins the majority of the seats does so with small majorities, and the party that wins the minority of the seats does so with very, very large majorities in their districts. That's the only way I can imagine how you could come up with a system in which one party won the popular vote statewide and yet got only a third of the total number of seats. I'm wondering if a criteria related to that issue is something that you considered, and if you decided not to pursue that, I would like to know why.
Yes, Chairman Garrett. And
I mean, may I simply say that my suggestion is that one of the ways of determining the fairness of a redistricting plan is, based on history, would it tend to produce a an outcome that matches statewide outcomes to roughly to the distribution of people in the body that you're electing?
Yes, some of the studies have looked at different issues of whether a commission is better. They've looked at competitiveness. They've looked at how closely you match the support statewide for a particular party versus the number of seats in the legislature and the number of congressional seats for that particular party. And, of course, it's a fundamental problem if you have significant disconnect between the amount of support you have for a party and the number of congressional seats that that party obtains in Congress or the number of seats in the state legislature. But there have been studies on different aspects. That is one of them. And according to the research that was done, and there aren't there very many, but it does show an improvement with the commission to match the percentages more closely with their state support for each of those parties. It also shows there was a good company called Azavia that did a review based on compactness, and that shows roughly whether you have reduced gerrymandering with the commission. And they did find there was reduced, in terms of more compact districts, you can use that as a proxy for reduced gerrymandering, and it did show that with a commission, it was reduced. Now, one of the books we read actually said, more important than whether you have the commission is, again, the type of commission and the rules that are in place, the criteria that are in place, and the type of commission can actually make things worse. If you have a partisan commission, then you end up with bipartisan gerrymanders, and it can be much more efficient than even the legislature doing the bipartisan gerrymandering. So it isn't just a commission versus a legislature, it's what type of commission, and we have set up a good combination of it's bipartisan. The first few members are not chosen where one party picks the first member and the other party picks the other member. It's agreeable, the first four are agreeable to both parties, and then they're picking the best qualified amongst the remaining five members. So it's a nonpartisan independent commission, which the research has shown does reduce gerrymandering in terms of the different measures, competitiveness, compactness, and matching percentages in the state legislature and in Congress to the state support.
Just a quick comment, if I could, on this topic. There are other people in this panel who understand redistricting a whole lot better than I do, but it does seem to me that one of the rough and ready criteria that the public is going to use when it tries to determine whether a districting plan is fair or not is whether or not in the typical election the outcomes of the group that you're electing is similar to the outcomes statewide based on the vote results. And about the only way I can imagine that you get there is that if there are really safe districts on one side, then there must be a few really safe districts on the other side, and the other districts are sort of based on are sort of up for grabs based on what the outcomes of the election happen to be in that set of years. I don't know of any other way to do it, but so far as I know, there's nothing in our current law that suggests that should be considered as a test of a reasonable outcome for something like that would be a test for a reasonable outcome of the election. Further, I would suggest that in Oregon, at least, a compactness test probably inures to the benefit of a party that has a more spread out distribution of its members as compared to a party that tends to be located primarily in the urban areas.
Mm-hmm.
And it would tend to move, would tend to lead to completely different results than the one I'm suggesting we should add.
Yes, Representative Barnhart and Chairman Garrett, we did talk to some experts that gave testimony over the first year in our research phase that looked at rural areas versus urban areas, and there's some discussions that we've had about built-in geographic advantage. We did not put a test into our proposed legislation, and it kind of gets into some areas where it's a little bit far afield from our particular proposals, and I won't get into that. We've had our own issues and discussions on this, our conversation, thank you very much for our meeting last time. I was thinking along the same lines. Did you want to?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Dembro.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. going back to the question of what worked and what didn't work in the 2011 redistricting, you know, from my perspective, there are a couple of things that didn't work. I lost some valuable constituents, one of whom writes for the Oregonian, and I'm looking at him right now. More to the point, my daughter was redistricted out of my district, and as the people who were involved in that process know, that was a severe blow to me. But putting that aside, I think, as you said, there was a lot that did work well in 2011, and part of it was due to personalities, part of it was due to the even number of Republicans and Democrats on the, you know, on that committee. On the House side, that was required, you know, by the fact that we were at a 30-30 split. On the Senate side, that was a voluntary decision on the part of the Senate president. And, you know, I'm wondering if you explored the notion of keeping this in the hands of the legislature, but just making sure that, you know, there would be an equal number of people who are working on this, and their job was to come up with something that would be, you know, acceptable to both chambers.
Can I answer that?
Yeah.
Thank you, Chairman Garrett, Representative Dembro. We did consider that. I think that part of what that takes is that partisanship doesn't factor in as heavily as it has in other states. So, for instance, in the state of Washington to the north, actually, they have a bipartisan commission. And in many states, they have actually just partisan members of the legislature or appointees from various offices who serve on the committee. And what tends to happen is kind of bipartisan gerrymander sweetheart deals of carve all the districts into being safe districts, which has problems then with voter responsiveness and overall voter participation. So although I think that there were very good things that happened in 2011, and we wish that they could be ensured to be repeated, it's hard to know how to write into law that, you know, individual relationships and a willingness to compromise should come to the forefront.
Yeah.
And if I could interject, I think drawing the maps together is a good step. I know that we had some people testify that in Congress, for example, they used to be traveling to and from their chambers together. They used to have lunch together, and they used to be actually discussing matters in chambers more than they do now. And just having to come up with the draft maps together would help tremendously. We don't have that in ours, but that sounds like a good idea.
Well, if I could follow up, Mr. Chairman. You know, I mean, I would argue that there are also benefits to having elected people doing the work in the public eye with a high degree of transparency. You know, that is, you know, if Representative Garrett was acting in a, you know, in a way that was deemed not to be in the public interest, he's a public figure and, you know, would be, you know, presumably vulnerable to a great deal of scrutiny in a way that the committee, you know, the independent commission members perhaps would not be. And, you know, I'm kind of wondering about that. I'm wondering if there's not a way to get the best of both worlds with certain safeguards in place.
Well, like in California, they have all citizens, and they're not necessarily experts or familiar with their particular districts. We have a combination of membership where you have some experts, the initial four, that are nominated and presumably know a lot about the districts and about the subject matter in combination with citizens applicants. So it's a little different from Washington. It's a little different from California. And we think we tried to integrate that knowledge of the districts and knowledge of redistricting into the process.
If I could say something,
sure.
Too. I think we really did discuss that issue quite a bit in the committee, that, you know, the value of legislative input versus the independence of a commission. And I think it really came to a trade-off where we made the call based on the question that, you know, it was important to create a situation where you no longer had that perception of a conflict of interest, for instance, of legislators drawing the lines. And, you know, that became a really dominant thing. Plus, we had seen research that showed that independent commissions did seem to create plans that tended to be less gerrymandered and match the the wishes of the voters in that state. So it's not something that we didn't consider. It's something we weighed heavily, and that's why we wanted legislative input to be an important part, plus the legislature appointing the first four members of the commission.
If I could follow up. And so are there other states that have a model where it's done by the legislature, but an equal number of from both parties, you know, that you could actually look to as a model for why this doesn't work, or is this kind of speculative?
You know, I could pursue that and get that information back.
Did you look, just on this line, did you look at the state of Iowa? I think it's Iowa that does it this way. When I was getting educated on this process, somehow they have it set up so that the maps are drawn by an independent office within the legislature, sort of like we would have maybe it'd be like our LFO or LRO. And they come up with a plan, and then the elected legislature has to approve it or not. And from what I understand, there's historically it has always been approved, and it would be very heavily frowned upon for the legislature leadership to start monkeying around with the plan that was developed. I don't know how they got that culturally kind of instilled, but it's an interesting model that we could. Did you look at that at all?
We did. Thank you for that question, Representative Garrett. It is an interesting model, and it's sort of a thing of it on its own. That it's really, they start with technocrats. Essentially, I forget what office they're out of, but it's sort of like the state geographers. And there are three of them, and they do the map making, all the things that you did, and you know how much that's involved.
Mm-hmm.
And then if I remember right, they present, they have like three or four different plans that are presented to the legislature. And in the end, the legislature has to approve one of those plans. Mm-hmm. We felt that, you know, Iowa is, it's, I don't know, if you're from Iowa, I'm sorry, but, you know, it doesn't have all the geographic boundaries.
They say the districts look like the checkerboard.
Right.
It's different.
I think it was our view that maybe the geography of Iowa made it easier for that kind of redistricting to occur.
I think that's probably true.
The kind of things we have in Oregon.
Representative Holvey, and then Representative Berger.
I'm fine. My question was answered.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, Representative Dembro brought up a similar question to mine. I just want to go back to the basic assumption of whether or not there really is an independent commission. And how is that better than a legislature where you do have, you know, voices and transparency in the public being able to, you know, call the question on things they disagree with? 'Cause as I'm reading the bill itself, it looks like you're putting quite a bit of power in the Secretary of State to, you know, accept the nominations of the persons, and the persons are being, you know, nominated by this group of people. The governor, the Supreme Court justices, you know, presidents of public universities, and having had talked to several people that have held those positions, though they may be independently elected, there some of them are extremely partisan, and so, you know, I'm just questioning the basic assumption of whether or not this independent commission really is any more independent or less partisan than the legislature. And you know, I guess that's sort of my take on it, as such. And so, I'm just questioning the fundamental assumption that you're making.
Representative Holdy and Chairman Garrett, thank you for the question. I think you're right to an extent. You can't take the politics out of people's hearts. We tried to come up with a method where the first four members have both familiarity with the subject and are agreeable to the both parties. The leadership of the House and Senate will select the first four. They've got a large number of nominees to choose from, so they're going to have very highly qualified first four members. And those four then are choosing the best qualified of all the citizen applicants. The only thing the Secretary of State is disqualifying people for are being a lobbyist, being an elected official, being a large donor for the prior 5 years. That's it. There's no discretion or subjectivity on the part of the Secretary of State.
Representative Denbrough.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Going back to that point about the initial four being selected by the legislature and then they select the additional five, why did you decide to do that? Why not have the legislature appoint all nine in a bipartisan way?
Representative Denbrough and Chairman Garrett, thank you. We did a compromise, and there were some people within our committee that had some differing ideas, but we eventually came up with this two-step membership selection process, having the legislature select alone didn't seem to capture both the expertise and the citizens' involvement. We wanted to have the citizens' applicants involved to make it a little more open process to everyone, similar to California, kind of a compromise or a hybrid system between California and some of the other states we looked at.
Yeah, and if I could follow up. I mean, I was thinking actually that the legislators would be presented with the large group. It wouldn't have to be from that smaller number. But I am, I'll say I'm philosophically, I have problems with self-replicating boards. I think you tend to get problems with them in terms of creating the potential for groupthink and that kind of thing. And so, I would be more partial personally to something where the legislature were involved in all the selections.
Representative Berger.
Yeah, just a comment. These folks have done some wonderful research. I don't think there's any right answer here on exactly how you get to this board notion, but to Representative Holvey's point, one of the reasons that I think we need to look to this is not just that we can't do a good job, but that the public's confidence in our ability to do this in a bipartisan way is not always strong. And by going to a commission system, we remove ourselves from that sense that we're deciding our own districts. And there's great power in that in terms of our citizens' confidence that we're not doing for ourselves. And I don't believe we did that in any way, shape, or form. Necessarily in this last, there was lots of puts and takes, and folks worked real hard to get to closure in this last round, but I don't have real confidence that going forward that's always going to be the case. And I totally agree that the legislative, there needs to be involvement from the legislative body directly in choosing for this commission and deciding on this commission. But the commission itself, if we can separate it from ourselves, I think will give citizens a better sense of confidence that we're not just kind of taking care of ourselves.
Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. a number of questions, some of which have been more or less asked or at least alluded to. And I share the concern of Representative Holvey that a question mark about the nonpartisanship, the objectivity of this independent commission. And I think I particularly do that when I look at the list of people that have been identified as being able to make nominations to that commission, including just about every elected officer from the local dog catcher to the governors of the state. Though they must not be in those elected offices at the time or have been for 5 years before. And then I look at, you know, the thing, they must also take some sort of vow that they will not seek an elected office for 5 years after having served, you know, on this. And I certainly would, I would certainly question this, that after they've already done their damage or their good work, as you would choose to look at it, what are they going to do 5 years later when elected to an office that is a political office, a state representative, as an example? It seems difficult for me to understand as such.
Sure. Thank you, Representative Jensen, for the question, Chair Garrett. So I heard two questions there. The first was about the entities that can nominate. And I think that you're certainly striking on an important issue and one that we struggled with greatly, which is how do you get people who have knowledge of statewide political issues into the committee so that there is some expertise that can inform the decisions that are made. And so we came up with the idea of having, you know, people, former elected officials, members of statewide organizations who should be able to look to their members, people known to them, you know, academics, and be able to tap people on the shoulder to say, you know, this person would serve in the best interest of the state and be knowledgeable about these issues. So I think that I think that answers that part, and please let me know if you have follow-up there. And then the second aspect of what the harm is in having somebody be able to run for elected office 5 years after they've served on the committee, our intent really is here to sever the line between people who draw the lines, then being able to run in the districts that they drew. So for instance, in California, the prohibition is 10 years, the entire term of service. They consider you a commissioner in the year after the decennial census, and your term as a commissioner is done when the next decennial census occurs. So it's 10 years that you're barred from holding elected office in California. We thought that with changes in population demographics and, you know, the minute details of how the lines are drawn, it seemed a bit far-fetched that somebody was going to be designing their own district 5 years down the road for their personal benefit. But I think that within, you know, a year or two, being able to move the line one way or the other to include or exclude your house, to include or exclude a, you know, wealthy neighborhood, I think that that's certainly not outside the realm of possibility and something that we wanted to remove from the table.
We're not worried about excluding or including your house. The only thing in your house we're worried about is where the bedroom is.
Right. That's the one that exactly. Thank you.
At any rate, that's that point, you know, in spite of your answer to that, still concerns me. We're looking at people who have been, you know, very politically active, and then they can't have been politically active for 5 years. And then we're looking at people who maybe haven't been politically active, but the process of this may turn them on to political activity, but they can't participate for more than until after 5 years. And if you talk to most leadership in, I think, both parties, finding candidates to run is not necessarily something that people are lined up at the courthouse or someplace waiting waiting to sign up, it gets to be, you know, kind of a difficult, sometimes sort of chore. But it seems to me you're asking members then become part of this, must become for 5 years apolitical. And I don't know how you enforce it in a lot of ways. I don't know, you know, I'd be very unsure, you know, of that. Just one comment I note in your presentation that you had when you're talking about the groups to solicit names from, you had here, you know, Indians, if I recall, but as I read through the material, I see that they have been the Commission on Indian Affairs has been omitted from the material. And I assume from the way you're looking that you're aware of that. And I suppose, therefore, there's an amendment waiting to happen if this is to proceed forward in that direction. When I first read it, without knowing what your presentation was going to be like, I was scratching my head trying to understand why they would be left off, but apparently, yeah. Section 7 talks about individuals who don't live in the state or who have a different address. And I was concerned in relationship accounting toward the pool of people that will determine how many, you know, from this area are going to be in District X and so forth. And I was concerned with that, with people who are outside of the state that still are registered in the state, still are citizens of the state. One of the obvious, I guess, examples right now would be military and the National Guard. And I'm wondering in that particular section if there's any confusion that might omit them from, or if it's possible there'd be any confusion that might omit them from being considered in the total pool for count.
Thank you for the question, Representative Jensen, Chairman Garrett. It's certainly not our intent to change anything with respect to military serving outside the state. The section that you're referencing, I think, it's bringing back the Senate bill, I think 516, that looked at how prisons, the population of prisons are counted within the state.
And it follows that, yeah.
So the intent is not to change anything about how serving military are counted. And as far as the previous question with respect to the change between which organizations would be tapped to nominate, our list is intended to be an example of organizations that have statewide knowledge, not to be an exclusive list. And you're right that in our original report, actually, we omitted unintentionally the Oregon Commission on Indian Services, and so that has been added. There's a sheet with revisions, requested revisions, that's included in the packets that were sent in, and that's why they have been added back into the presentation. Thank you for noticing.
Could I comment, too, on something?
Sure.
Thank you, Representative Garrett and Representative Jensen.
Yes.
you mentioned a concern about citizens who weren't political getting involved in making decisions about redistricting, political things, and then maybe getting interested in, you know, wanting, having to wait 5 years, et cetera. My experience is, especially from being in the City Club, there are many citizens who have a lot of interest in political issues who don't want to be involved in partisan politics. And I think at least some of the people on this commission would be that kind of person. They're well informed. We certainly know people like that in City Club. I'm sure there are other organizations throughout the state. That this would be very desirable, and it would give a fresh look at some of these things by people who are indeed informed and interested in this subject. Thank you.
All right, well, thank you very much. Yes.
Well, I just was going to go on with another question, if I may.
Sure. We have a few more people who want to testify on this, so let's try and maybe keep it somewhat concise. But yeah, go ahead.
I note in the written material, though it exists in the Constitution, I guess now, that the eligible age to serve in the legislature is 18, or in these offices is 18, is 21. I would respectfully submit that I have a constituent in my district who's missing two legs, that was a consequence of his service in the Near East. And I know Oregon has talked about this issue of voting age before, or serving age eligibility. But I think this would be, if this bill is to move forward, I think it would be a marvelous opportunity to reduce that age to 18, which is the age that they need to be to go off to war and represent and defend the principles on which this bill is attempting to improve on. So.
Thank you. It's a good idea.
That's
finished? Okay.
Just a comment. That's
We have a few more witnesses, but I really want to thank you for the work that went into this. I think you've heard a lot of interest here in the committee in these issues, even if we don't maybe have consensus about all the high-level threshold questions. But again, thank you very much for the presentation.
Thank you.
Norman Terrill, Kate Titus, and Rick Bennett. Please go ahead.
Chair Garrett and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Norman Turrell. I'm here representing the League of Women Voters of Oregon, and yes, indeed, men are invited to be members of the League and have been invited since the 1970s when I joined. I've also been a member of the study committee of for redistricting that we've mentioned here in my testimony. The study that we did actually was the basis by which the City Club started its study. Beyond that, I'm a member of the National Board of the League of Women Voters. I'm the first man to ever do that, and still the only man, but it's more of a challenge than an honor. And lastly, back in the 1980s, I helped advocate on behalf of Common Cause at that time in Washington State for the redistricting commission that is now instituted there by constitutional amendment. So I know a great deal about redistricting. The League of Women Voters is a 93-year-old grassroots nonpartisan political organization that encourages informed and active participation in government. The League did a study on redistricting in Oregon in 2007, and you see the reference there in my testimony. The League is one of the few organizations that I know, along with the City Club, that actually studies issues before it takes a position and has an opinion on a subject. Based on the League's study and position, a independent redistricting commission is the best practices for drawing representative political districts. And we can wholeheartedly support HJR 17 and HB 2686. I would first like to impress upon you the urgencies of these proposals. The closer that we get to the next redistricting in 2021, the harder it is going to be to accomplish this kind of reform, because the political considerations will get harder and harder as people begin to look forward to what their districts will look like in the next redistricting. Secondly, I want to discuss the criteria. We had a little discussion earlier about the criteria. This is really a suggested change to the proposal that the criteria be rearranged into two groups. The first group is mandatory criteria, such as equal population or nesting of districts or following federal law and judicial orders. The state has no opportunity to change some of that, and so those are mandatory sorts of criteria. Then there's another set of criteria that should be co-equally considered together, as where there's a lot of discretion that's involved in considering these things, and these are the criteria such as create geographic boundaries, political boundaries, communities of interest, transportation links, and so on. And in Oregon, with our varied geography, for example, you don't want to put boundaries across mountaintops or across rivers, it may be even, because those are where the communities of interest are. So these are kind of co-equally non-mandatory, but things that should be considered in a redistricting. To the this second group of criteria, the League would like to suggest that we add a criteria for partisan competitiveness based on our study and our position. This would allow voters to be more likely to be able to choose public officials that are favorable to them. What I'm talking about here is the difference between swing districts and safe districts. If you maximize the number of swing districts, the voters win in this process. And they then have the maximum choice in how their government is run or in the representatives that they have. Part of gerrymandering in the past has mainly focused on getting districts that were safe for public officials. And we would, if the process is done in a open, transparent method, then this can be actually a big boon for the voters. Finally, I want to impress on you the importance of this legislation. Without it, our voters and districts would be susceptible to the kinds of distortions of democratic representation that we have seen in other states, and I'm referring to states like Texas and Virginia and Illinois and so on. Then two last points I want to make. There's some things that I want to correct that were talked about before. The process in Iowa is a little different from what was described. There, the professional staff of the legislature is walled off from any outside influences, and they draw new maps and kind of throw it over the fence to the legislature, and the legislature then says yay or nay, do they like that plan or not. If they turn it down, then it goes back to the professional staff, and this is all done in secret, by the way, that they can do this three times, and the third time the legislature has to accept the proposal from the staff. Now I want to speak to the point about nonpartisanship in the commission. It's perhaps more accurate to describe this commission that we proposed as a multipartisan commission, where we're really trying to balance the different political interests in the state so that the process is removed from the highly partisan arena of the legislature, potentially highly partisan, and to a place where the political interests are balanced. And in that way, it's maybe better to call it a multipartisan commission. So thank you for the opportunity to discuss this legislation. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Chair Garrett, members of the committee, my name's Kate Titus. I'm the executive director of Common Cause Oregon. Common Cause is a 43-year-old organization that works to safeguard and improve the democratic process. It has a long history on the issue of redistricting. Most recently here in Oregon, during the last redistricting cycle, we were involved in helping to increase and improve participation in the hearings, particularly among underrepresented populations. We testified before the House and Senate redistricting committees, offered suggestions, shared our perspective in opinion pieces in the media, and after the process was over, released a report applauding the successes of the 2011 process, but also reaffirming the need for redistricting reform and laying out specific recommendations. And that report is on our website. So I'm here today to register Common Cause support for the two measures that are before you. Common Cause supports an independent commission. We recognize that it will not entirely remove politics from what's inherently a political process, but it can make the process less political, and that's important. And it can, as Representative Berger pointed out, change the perception of the public that legislators are essentially choosing their own voters, which undermines the credibility of the legislature. We also support the bill to address distortions by how we currently count prison populations. And I'm sure you're familiar with the term used to describe that situation of prison gerrymandering. I think the term itself indicates that it's not the most accurate way to determine representation, and it seems to Common Cause that it should be an obvious and uncontroversial step to resolve that so that some populations are not getting inflated representation over others. Lastly, I would just, I'd like to emphasize three recommendations that were covered in our report that are complementary to the bills in question. First, no matter who draws the lines, we think it's important that any redistricting reform not weaken Oregon's redistricting criteria, which we believe actually are some of the clearest and most detailed in the country. It would be good to codify some of what's not actually in law, and I just throw out one example. During the last 2011 redistricting process, the commission did a pretty good job going around the state and gathering input from the public, but nowhere is that actually required by law. So putting some of our best practices in law would be a useful step. Second recommendation, it should be a top priority to end the use of political data behind closed doors. The current practice is to not officially use political data so as not to give the appearance that we're trying to get results that are for partisan interests. And it may sound counterintuitive, but Common Cause believes that actually you can't avoid using the political data. The insiders will use that on their own, and what you have by not officially using it is a sort of backdoor process that lends itself to sweetheart gerrymandering. And what we should have is a transparent process where the public actually has access to that data. Finally, I would emphasize the importance of public participation in the process. And in one particular way, I'd like to point out, we think it's really important to have public participation and a sufficient number of hearings on the draft maps themselves. It's really commendable, without it being required, that in the last process there were a good number of hearings, and including on the draft maps. But that doesn't always happen. And to hold hearings for the public in the early part of the process before the maps are part of the process is really just a hollow exercise if it's not followed then by a chance for the public to engage with the maps themselves. I'll leave it at that. Thank you for taking my testimony.
Thank you. Mr. Bennett.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, Rick Bennett, Director of Government Relations for AARP Oregon, speaking in support of House Joint Resolution 17 and House Bill 2686. AARP endorses independent redistricting commissions primarily for the same reason as voiced by Representative Berger. We see the commissions as a means of assuring that legislators with partisan interests cannot draw district lines favorable to their own election or their party's election, avoiding the conflicts of interest associated with that and the public cynicism of the process. My written testimony, I provided a brief, a very brief outline of the key aspects of our public policy related to government integrity and civic engagement, and I would just say that the resolution and the bill under your consideration is very much in keeping with our public policy, and we would urge your support of both. Thank you.
Thank you. I was going to make a comment, Noren, you brought up an interesting issue of competitiveness of districts. When we were doing this work 2 years ago and we were doing our public hearings, I think probably far and away, and I'll ask staff because she was there with me, but I think the refrain we heard from voters more than any other single concern was to draw districts that are fair and that give the maximize the chance of competitive elections. And that's not in the statutory criteria that we currently have in the law. And what we kind of discovered in the midst of doing this work is that if you take that seriously and try and maximize competition in districts, you start to run it into a problem, which is that it's inconsistent with your other criteria. Because if you're going to respect communities of interest and transportation links, et cetera, you are going to naturally produce districts that lean one way or the other, and with a small number of truly competitive districts. And there's a whole lot of literature on this. You're familiar with like the Big Sort, that type of literature about how we have sorted ourselves as society into more like-minded kind of groupings. And so this issue of whether to have competition and make that a priority is very interesting to me, because I get it. I think all things being equal, we want healthy competition between the parties, and yet it's not necessarily consistent with the other things that we are valuing here. Any other questions or comments? All right, thank you both, all three of you. Two more. Cindy Booth and Bruce Miller, please. Excuse me.
Good afternoon, Chair Garrett and members of the committee. My name is Cindy Booth. I'm with the Oregon Department of Corrections, Transition and Reentry Administrator. I'm here today to provide information as to how House Bill 2686 impacts the Department of Corrections. I have provided written testimony that further details the impact. We are also working on a fiscal with regard to our information systems. Basically, this bill would require the department report regarding inmate residents, last known residents prior to their incarceration with the Department of Corrections. And the department's information systems don't collect information in that fashion. Rather, under other statutes, we are focused on the county of residence for release purposes. And so our information systems are geared toward that. So we anticipate a fiscal impact to repurpose, so to speak, our information systems to collect and report that information in a way required by the legislation, and we'll provide that information as soon as it's ready. Thank you. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Bruce Miller. I'm Senior Staff Counsel in the Office for the State Court Administrator. I just wanted to point out a wordsmithing issue that that we spotted in House Bill 2686 in Section 6 sub 5. This is talking about the inmate populations, and I think there may be an inconsistency with wording in HDR 17, so if you choose to move these forward, you might want to address that. HDR 17 talks about state legislative districts and congressional districts. 2686 Section 6 talks about legislative districts. You may want to have consistent terminology there, and you may also want to consider whether you just want that section to apply to state legislative districts or if you also want it to apply to congressional districts. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Denver, please.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. So I want to ask about 2686. For inmates, you know, I realize that you don't have addresses, good addresses for where they were before, and so presumably you also don't know where they were registered to vote before, if they were, in fact, registered. But I wonder if that's a consideration or that could be a consideration at all in looking at this.
Chair Garrett, Representative Dimbrough, it is a consideration. We can look into it. I do not know the percentage of inmates who may have been registered to vote prior to their involvement in the crimes that led them to prison, but it is certainly something that we can look at, the voter registration rules.
I'm not sure that's relevant, really. I mean, here we're just talking about the size of the populations, right. But do you know if how this issue is handled in other states? Is there some kind of literature within the world of corrections on how to properly count inmates for purposes of size of a district?
Yeah, Chair Garrett, Representative Dimbrough, we have not posed the question, and we'll be happy to do so. I do know that Oregon is unique in that it allows persons with felony convictions to vote. So I know that a number of states do not. But we will pose that question certainly within the corrections community outside of Oregon.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
I mean, they can vote after their release, not while they're in prison, right?
Chair Garrett and Representative Dimbrough, in Oregon, that is true. Not all states, however. But we will provide that information for you in the committee. Thank you.
All right, thank you both
thank
very
you.
Much. That completes the hearing on these two bills, so I'll close the public hearing on HJR 17 and HB 2686. Again, thanks to our lead presenters for bringing us this concept and to those of you who took the time to share your views. Appreciate it. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2887. I'll go up to the front and introduce this bill, and then we have two witnesses to speak to it.
And committee, as Representative Garrett goes to the front, HB 2887 prescribes process for adjudicating reapportionment of congressional districts, forms panel of judges to decide upon reapportionment in the event the Legislative Assembly fails to enact reapportionment or upon petition challenging reapportionment of congressional districts enacted by the Legislative Assembly.
Thank you, Vice Chair and members. For the record, Chris Garrett, State Representative from District 38. House Bill 2887 is also a redistricting bill, and it's an attempt to fill a void in state law that concerns what happens if the legislature fails to adopt a congressional redistricting plan. Constitutionally, if we fail to adopt a legislative redistricting plan, it goes to the Secretary of State. That's not the case for congressional lines, and the law is silent about what happens if we fail to do the job. So I have proposed the legislation before you to really set up a mechanism to avoid what has happened in the last couple of examples. To give you some background, in 2001, the legislature did not successfully complete a congressional plan, and it resulted in litigation between principally the Democrat and Republican parties. And that litigation on the merits was preceded by a dispute about venue and where the case should be heard. and Mr. DiLorenzo is going to come up after me and speak from his own experience in dealing with that. Ultimately, that case was heard in Multnomah County, and 10 years later, no doubt at Mr. DiLorenzo's suggestion, the Republican Party filed an action in Yamhill County Circuit Court in the middle of the legislative session. This is the 2011 session. In what I am certain was an attempt to ensure that if we failed to adopt a plan here, the litigation would be resolved in a forum other than Multnomah County. And fortunately, we did enact a plan, and that issue never needed to be resolved. But the reason I brought this bill is that I think it would benefit the process to attempt to find a mechanism that both parties can view as fair, that eliminates the uncertainty and gamesmanship and possible venue shopping that would go with seeking a resolution of redistricting. So I have, I basically brought you this bill. It was not done in consultation with either party or the courts. So I want to make clear, this is nothing but a starting point from mostly my own head. And I welcome the comments that I know we're going to receive from Mr. Miller, representing the Judicial Department, Mr. DiLorenzo, and we also, at some point, will be receiving input from the Democratic side. But my ultimate goal is to come up with a bill that provides some certainty in the process that both parties can view as a fair compromise. In this draft, it would be, the venue would be Marion County. We would have the litigation resolved in front of a panel of judges, one from each congressional district. That, again, is just my sort of rough draft and idea. I'm happy to consider others. But I think we do need to fill this void in the law because it's not healthy for the process and not in the interest of either party to have this much uncertainty surrounding the litigation process. Thank you for your attention. So we have Mr. DiLorenzo and Mr. Miller, I think, are the only witnesses on this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is John DiLorenzo. I'm a partner with the law firm of Davis Wright Tremaine, but I am here today on my own accord, speaking for myself only. I want to thank the chair for his kind words, and I want to assure him that the filing in Yamhill County was meant to provide him with a tool to assist in legislative resolution, which was exactly where the constitutional responsibilities resided. I am here in favor of House Bill 2887. 22 years ago, I represented the plaintiffs in federal court litigation, which ended up redistricting congressional districts, and that was done through a three-judge federal panel. 12 years ago, I had the pleasure to represent a number of parties in Perrin versus Kitzhaber, which was the congressional redistricting litigation in 2001. We learned several things at that time from our experience, which involved a one-day federal court hearing and a two-week Multnomah County Circuit Court trial. First of all, we learned that the federal courts will abstain from any further consideration of congressional redistricting cases if it appears that state processes can accomplish the same in time. And that was basically driven by a U.S. Supreme Court case called Grove versus Emerson, which is a case based on federalism and automatically requires federal courts to defer to state court processes. The second we learned was that even given a binary choice, and the circuit court judge in our case had only two choices, basically a Republican plan or the Democrat plan. In that case, the court still required a two-week-long hearing. Had the court determined to design its own plan, the process could have taken months. The third thing we learned is that every party who participates, no matter whether they win or lose on the remedy, is still entitled to some measure of attorney's fees. And in a circumstance in which not only Republicans, Democrats, but independents and other parties might decide to chime in, I mean, they have a right to have some say over where the congressional district lines are drawn. The amount of money that the state would end up paying to all of the attorneys would be fairly substantial. And I think that was one of the other reasons that helped drive the settlement between the Republicans and the Democrats during the 2011 session, that among other factors. The reasons I think this is a good bill is because, as Chair Garrett stated, it eliminates the race to the courthouse. The first case had been filed by the Democrats in 2001 in Multnomah County before the legislature had adjourned. 10 years later, the case was filed in Yamhill County. So it eliminates the race to the courthouse. Secondly, though, it ensures geographic diversity and familiarity on the panel. It provides judges from every single congressional district, which I think is very useful. Three-court federal judge panels used to hear redistricting cases. There's no reason why a five-judge state panel could not just as easily do the same. It also increases the public perception of fairness, because the public knows that there is a decision maker from every single congressional district on the panel, familiar with the geographic intricacies and other differences that are of importance to people who live in those congressional districts. And finally, it will resolve multiple filings and would be a very convenient place to consolidate cases if four or five cases are filed at once. So I heartily recommend the bill. I think it makes a lot of sense with respect to judicial efficiency. It also makes a lot of sense with respect to fairness and the perception of fairness. I know that the Department of Justice has a few helpful suggestions. If asked, I am more than willing to volunteer some time to help you devise a piece of legislation that works and accomplishes those goals. So thank you for the invitation to talk with you today.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bruce Miller. I'm senior staff counsel in the Office for the State Court Administrator. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for inviting us to review this bill and offer our comments. I do have a list of things that you may want to consider regarding the judicial review process. In Section 2.1, it's probably worthwhile to make clear, and for venue and filing, that a party is required to file a party's petition in Marion County Circuit Court. The bill as drafted has them file the petition with the panel, and frankly, that doesn't get litigation started. You need to get it into the state court system. You may want to consider making clear that in order for the panel to review the legislature's failure to adopt a reapportionment plan, party must file a petition the same as they would if they objected to the plan that the legislature adopted. It would probably be helpful to have a specific section in there that allows consolidation of cases in the event that multiple challenges are filed in Marion County so that they can all be heard at once, as well as allow the filing and consideration of amicus briefs and oral argument on those briefs. Suggestions for Section 2 sub 2, you may want to consider removing the chief judge and the presiding judge from the panel to reduce the panel to one judge from each congressional district, with seven judges on the panel, you could end up with two or even three from one congressional district. It would also make the panel a little bit more of a workable size. Five is a little easier to work than seven. The measure specifically says the number five in there, you may want to remove that because the number of congressional districts could change. We could lose one or gain one, so it makes it easier if you redraft it a different way. The bill as drafted doesn't say who appoints the judges. Our suggestion is to have the Chief Justice appoint the judges and have the Chief Justice designate one of them as the presiding judge of the panel. And we feel these judges should come not only from the pool of existing circuit court judges, but you may want to include senior judges in that pool as well, because you get a depth of experience there, plus it broadens the pool a little bit, gives you more bodies to draw from. The bill as drafted talks about random selection. We think it might be best to remove that to add flexibility and give us the assurance of finding judges who are willing and able to serve. If you randomly choose a judge from a small county who's in the middle of a three-month aggravated murder trial, it's simply not going to work out very well. So this gives the Chief Justice the flexibility that the Chief needs to make the proper selections, taking into account the availability and various other factors that go in, the judge's health that might prevent travel, some things like that. We also think it would be helpful to extend the deadline for the panel to issue a decision to give us time to appoint the panel. The panel is not going to be sitting there ready to go. We need to have time to appoint them. Then this will come to them. We'll need that little extra cushion. And in connection with that, we would also request that you push back the time for the Supreme Court to issue its decision on direct review by a similar amount of time, and it would push it back to the existing deadline right now, which I believe is December 15th. We believe these changes will create a smoother process for judicial review, and with my testimony, I've included on Attachment A a redline version of the bill with my edits, and Attachment B is a clean version of the bill with my edits. Thank you.
Thank you. I really appreciate your suggestions. They're all very constructive. I think maybe we could just get together and kind of work group this and come up with a final product. Are there questions for the panel? All right. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That completes our testimony, so I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2887, and the committee's adjourned.